Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 90. My name is Terry Frost and I keep clicking that thing. And this time around, I'm going to be winging it. There's a few things I want to talk about, but pretty much there's not going to be a format to it. It's going to be free association and random thoughts coruscating through the synapses of my mind and spraying out through this microphone. So I'm not sure how it's going to go, but sit back. I'm going to get the contact details out of the way and we'll get this benighted little fucker going. Back soon. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in colour, 3D, anamorphic. It doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction or horror or fantasy or anything that takes our mind. So the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Please be aware that this podcast does have swearing in it. So if you're going to be listening to it on speakers, make sure there are no children around, unless you want them to learn wider vocabulary than they already have. Okay, so how is everybody? I'm living in a weird country at the moment because we don't actually have a government. There was an election yesterday, but the outcome is still undecided. It's very, very close, and the goodies versus the baddies, and everybody is having conniptions about it, and we won't know until Tuesday whether the evil empire or the republic are going to be running the country. Which leaves us in a weird headspace, and I was very, very invested in this election. I was really hitting social media incredibly hard about it and tweeting and posting funny pictures about it and doing all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff, and it's pretty much exhausted me. For us, 8 weeks is a long election campaign, mostly because we don't have that kind of lackadaisical attitude that the Americans have in their year-long election campaigns. It's all very intense and hard, and the media is saturated with it, and social media in particular is saturated with it, so it is quite intense for us, and not to have a result is kind of disappointing. We want to be able to cheer the politicians we like and boo the ones we don't and see the ones we don't have a fall. And, you know, there's a kind of tribal goodies versus baddies thing happening here. And not to have a result kind of shortcuts at it, short circuits it a little bit. And everybody in the country woke up this morning and went, what the fuck? Yeah, as I said, it's a very unusual place for this country to be. The bad side from the look of things, and this kind of veers into futurist science fiction in some ways, is that it looks like the Senate, the upper house, is going to have a bunch of very racist people in it. Now, they didn't need to get very much of a vote because they had what's called a double disillusion election. And the double disillusion election means all the senators are up for re-election all at once, which means that people who run for the Senate only need to get half as many votes to get into the Senate, which means, of course, that people who don't get many votes and are crazy, racist, evangelistic, apocalyptic fools, basically, will get a Guernsey. A superannuated shock jock DJ called Darren Hinch is getting into the Senate after confessing that he has never voted in an election in his life. So we've got a broken process here. We've got a broken polity in our country. And nonetheless, well, you know, I went out this morning and did the usual things I do. Went to the bakery and got some lunch stuff and all of that kind of thing. And things move along anyway. But it's a very, very weird world I'm living in at the moment politically in Australia. The other thing is, just after midnight last night, the Prime Minister made a speech where he basically cracked the shits at the whole country and was quite kind of nasty and sulky about the fact that he didn't win outright being the millionaire ex-merchant banker that he is, and of course having a right to rule didn't really happen this time around. And he didn't do the usual gracious things that any prime minister does, which is to commiserate with the people who lost their parliamentary seats and to thank people who had worked very hard trying to get him into parliament, to congratulate how well the other person's done, all that kind of good sportsmanship kind of stuff. Just didn't happen last night. And, I love politics for the psychology of it. The way it reveals character is, for me, a really interesting thing, and much more interesting than, in some ways, some fictional drama. It's even though you can look at Game of Cards and see what you think really happens in Washington and all that kind of thing, to see in reality that psychology and that that revelation of character flaws and character strength as well, and inspirational oration, is for me really an interesting thing. To see the clash of ideas is always interesting, except when they're old ideas and they don't really relate to the world as it is now. One of the problems, of course, with modern politics is that in a vastly and fast-changing world, the old ideologies are crumbling. I mean, we're in late-stage capitalism. The economic systems of the world aren't doing too well. We're going to have to find a new way for people to trade between each other in a world post-scarcity, in a world where a lot of things are computerized, and where jobs are going to change by their very nature. And see, here's a science fiction aspect of it for you. We're going to have to look at things like guaranteed income for people, and that's going to cause vast changes to the way our world works, and it's going to piss off a lot of entrenched privilege in a lot of ways. So, we're moving. We've always, and here's this big secret. Here is the big secret of the world. Well, one of them, there's about 5 million, but here's another one of them. We've always lived in a science fiction world. For the people in the past and for people who are older than ourselves, new things are science fictional. They're strange and challenging and baffling and incomprehensible and scary, and a lot of people get scared by change. A lot of people get scared by innovation, whether it's innovation of thought, innovation of culture, or innovation of society. And, you know, that of course, makes them react in a way that tries to prevent that change. That's why old people in the UK voted overwhelmingly for the Brexit. It's why overwhelmingly old people support conservative political parties. It's all a part of our nature to try to protect what we have and to be threatened by change. I mean, I'm not saying just where change and where the way the world is heading without criticism, without analysis, and without input. I'm saying that, you know, be aware that things are going to change whether you want them to or not, and try to kind of guide that change and try to work out how you're going to adapt to the things you can't alter. We live in a science fiction world, and the big science fiction trope in that world is what if. What if we do this? How would the world be better? What if we do this? How will my life be better? What if I do this? How will my life change? We're in science fiction, and people who are, like me, lifelong absorbers of science fiction in various media, books, television, movies, even radio, kind of should have an inside running to adapting that change. We don't always do that. In fact, there are a lot of people I know that have been fans of science fiction since Jesus was playing Cowboys and Indians, who actively resist change. They use old computers. They don't use social media at all. Well, they feel threatened more than excited by new things. And it always struck me as silly. You've got all this training, you've got all this knowledge of science fiction, you know all of the dystopias and cautionary tales and utopias and technological innovations and intelligent robots, and you've been living with that shit in the culture you absorb and the entertainment you absorb for a very long time. But when it actually starts to get real, you feel threatened to back away from it. I never understood that philosophy. It's really a strange and baffling thing for me. I'm a neophile. I like new things. I like change. I like weirdness, and I like unexpected things that happen in history. I'm optimistic about the future because I think if I'm pessimistic, I'm part of the problem. But to be optimistic and to kind of encourage other people to look at the world as an opportunity, I think I'm trying to be, I think I'm being positive if I do that. If I just say, well, everything's going to shit and everything's rotten and all politicians are corrupt and all of these new technologies and social media and new ways of watching movies and the changes to television and all that is overwhelmingly negative. If I take all of those attitudes, I'm not enjoying the world. And the world is here for me to enjoy. I'm convinced of that. I think that satire is a powerful weapon against oppression. I think that knowledge is, and having options always makes your life better than if you don't have knowledge. And if you're actively ignorant about things that you need to know, it's going to fuck you up. There's no two ways about it. It is seriously going to fuck you up. I really enjoy new things. I like seeing what's coming down the pipeline. I can choose. I mean, what we have most of all in the 21st century on this clay and granite planet is we have choices of what we like and what we don't like. We can choose to avoid reality television if it's not our thing, which in fact it isn't for me. I don't really enjoy that a lot. I don't enjoy watching crime shows on television, true crime stuff. Sal loves it. But for me, it's just something I avoid because I lived in a true crime world when I was a child and I walked away from that. But yeah, you can pick and choose the stuff you like. You can become an expert in the most obscure things and somebody will like it somewhere. We live in a time of unprecedented connectivity. It doesn't matter what your fetish and what obscure TV show you like and what your sexual kink is and what your political belief is. Somewhere out there, there's a community for you and there are people for you. And we can get in touch with each other about those things more than we ever could. Of course, there's a downside to that. There are communities of people who have some very dark and nasty interests who get together. But of course, that is in a lot of ways policed. And there is everybody from Interpol to white hat hackers working to identify those people and to stop them. But nonetheless, if you're interested in something, there's a community out there for you somewhere. And that's kind of cool because what it does, and yeah, this isn't a universal panacea for this problem, but what it does is it makes people less lonely. It makes them able to find somebody somewhere who likes the same thing they do. The way you did in a playground where you watched a TV show that not many other kids liked, but there was always one goofy kid somewhere who liked the same shit as you did. And that's what the internet is. It's an enormous playground where you find the kids who have the same interests as you. So yes, the changes to politics and the changes to technology and the changes to society and culture and economies and all sorts of things like that are crazily threatening, but they're also opportunities. And what you've got to do is navigate through that shit to find your best self and to be that best self. And you'll get there if you want to, and there'll be people who will try to pull you down while you do, and there'll be other people who actively encourage you while you do. And that's one of the crazily interesting things about the times we live in. It's never been easier in this world to find the tribe you belong to. So on that note of uncharacteristic optimism, I'm going to take a break. When I get back, I'm going to talk about old TV shows, old genre TV shows that I really like. That's Edward Astley's theme to one of the TV series I'm going to talk about. In fact, the first one I'm going to talk about, it's a TV series called The Champions from about 1968 and 69, it was. It was an ITV TV series, an English one. It ran 30 episodes, all of which, by the way, and this is useful, are on YouTube. So you can watch them all there and enjoy them. They're very much of their time. They're 1960s spy espionage kind of TV series, produced by Monty Berman, as indeed a lot of these kind of things were. But this one's got a twist. It's got a kind of science fictional occult kind of twist to it. It stars Stuart Damon, Alexandra Bastido, and William Gaunt as three agents for a United Nations law enforcement agency called Nemesis. The twist is that they were in a plane crash in Tibet and were saved from that plane crash by a lost city. And the people of the lost city gave them unusual powers. They've got superhuman senses, superhuman strength, and also extrasensory perception, which is never a bad thing if you're going to be in law enforcement. A lot of it was studio-based stuff filmed in the UK, but I kind of like it. It's got that jaunty theme tune, which, by the way, wasn't by Edward Astley. I was wrong. It was by Tony Hatch. And they're kind of very much, like a lot of other Monty Berman TV product of the time, they were a lot of fun to watch. You get a lot of character actors turning up in them. You get some unusual situations. It's got a little touch of the Avengers, not the Tony Stark Avengers, but the old school Patrick McNee, Diana Rigg Avengers about it. And of course they're of their time, and they've really dated in some ways. The sexual politics isn't the best at times, but nonetheless, it's revisiting them. I didn't find it as disappointing as I had a lot of other things that I kind of went back and revisited from around that time. Now, Monty Berman did a bunch of other TV series, some of which are also on YouTube, like The Baron with Steve Forrest, who's one of the stiffest actors in the known universe. Also, big favourites of mine, Department S, and Jason King, both starring Peter Wingard, which is still a lot of fun. I've got both of the box sets of those two, and I've also got The Champions, of course. And they're, I've got a great fondness for those 1960s spy TV series that the UK did. They were often done on a limited budget, but the writing was uniformly good. The production values were pretty good. And you got to see lots of different actors doing different things, people who went on to do greater things in some cases. Donald Sutherland would turn up in these things, or people who had in the past done really good movies. So between that, it's good fun to just kind of dip into that. It's very much popcorn viewing, but the extrasensory perception stuff, the format at the start of the shows are quite interesting as well. What they do is they set up the villain and the problem in the pre-title sequence, you know, like somebody dies in a mysterious way or somebody does something out of character and something happens. And then they have the title sequence. Then they have a little bit of a kind of post-title sequence where you see a demonstration of the superpowers the three protagonists have in different situations. And that's a little bit of fun. Then they go and have an interview with their boss, Tremaine, played by another interesting character actor, Anthony Nichols. If you look through his IMDb, you'll see there's a lot of good stuff there. And they'll go off, have the adventure, overcome adversity, win through the day, and that's the end of the episode about 50 minutes later. So they're, I like the actors as well. Stuart Damon, kind of an American actor, very good looking. William Gaunt, who's not quite as good looking, an English character actor, did some really good Shakespeare later in his career. If you look around on YouTube and other places, you can see him do some really great Shakespearean character roles. And then we've got Alexandra Bastido, who went on to do a Jess Franco movie called The Blood-Soaked Bride, amongst other things. Didn't really have a big career. She did turn up in the first of the most recent Batman movies, the three that had Christian Bale in them. She turned up as a kind of an extra in that, not long before her death. But yeah, a strikingly beautiful actress. I had a crush on her when I was young for a very long time, and which is another reason why, of course, I'm fond of the TV series. These days, if you have a TV series with somebody with superhuman powers, you have one person with superhuman powers. In this one, they have three. And that kind of builds for a kind of buddy feel about it. You know, they can play off against each other. They can help each other out because they've got ESP and they can talk to each other over great distances. So the ensemble works really well because the premise sets it up. And, I've rewatched a couple of episodes now. And I really do. They're kind of fun to take a look at. And even from an historical viewpoint, you can look at the cars and the costumes and the set designs and the clothing and all sorts of things. And because it's late 60s set design and art design and clothing and cars, they're all pretty groovy from our point of view. The 60s is one of those eras where the clothing and the interior design was a bit outrageous, it's kind of in tune with the way we see things now. And so we perceive it as being a really kind of nice-looking mise-en-scene. I'm not sure what it is about the 1960s, actually, where all of that kind of comes together for us more than the 1970s or the 1980s. And I don't know whether it's me seeing it with my eyes as a man of a certain age, but I think the 60s works better aesthetically for people in the 21st century. So I'm not going to talk about any other TV series. I'm actually going to save them and maybe do one TV series per podcast episode where I kind of look at stuff that I look upon fondly from previous decades. But I want to kind of go at a different tangent now and talk about political science fiction and how politics is kind of intrinsic to science fiction movies.
Seneca, why do you think we have a winner?
What do you mean?
I mean, why do we have a winner? Hope.
Hope?
Hope. It is the only thing stronger than fear. A little hope is effective. A lot of hope is dangerous. A spark is fine, as long as it's contained. So, contain it.
That's a little bit of Donald Sutherland and Wes Bentley from The Hunger Games playing President Snow and Seneca Crane, where they're talking about why they have The Hunger Games. Politics is rife in science fiction movies. I was just kind of thinking of the many ways it's a kind of crucial cog to many, many science fiction films. Even something as benighted and as we know that I dislike, as Star Wars has a lot of political stuff. It's very shallow and facile and simplistic political stuff. But you have the Galactic Senate and you have the politics of the people on the Death Star. You have a lot of politics in there as side issues to the heroics. And the odd thing about it is that the heroes very often don't get much involved with politics, which is a very, very American thing. Politics is at the heart of a lot of the tropes that we like in our science fiction. Dystopias, 1984, is incredibly political. Soylent Green has a political subtext. Somebody made the decision to make Soylent Green. Not the movie, but the actual product of Soylent Green. Even though we never see it from the viewpoint of the cop played by Charlton Heston. Somebody made that decision, and that was a political decision. Then you've got something as dystopian and horrible, and I won't be watching the movie again because I find it so triggering, as The Handmaid's Tale, which is about politics and religion and the where they meet and create one of the darkest dystopias in science fiction cinema, where women are suppressed to a disgusting degree. On the 17th, and in the real world it happens too, on the 17th of April in 1975, I remember the day because it happens to have been my birthday, in Cambodia, Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge created a science fiction concept called Year Zero. The idea behind Year Zero, and I'm reading this from Wikipedia, is that all culture and traditions within a society must be completely destroyed or discarded, and a new revolutionary culture must replace it, starting from scratch. whole history of a nation or people before year zero is deemed largely irrelevant, as it will ideally be purged and replaced from the ground up. That's a crazily science fiction concept. And it was tried in the killing fields of Cambodia in the 1970s. And without science fiction, those kind of ideas wouldn't have flourished. The big question of science fiction, which is always what if, ... is something that leads itself to political questions. Science fiction novels, of course, are very political as well. A lot of the classics of science fiction have innately political themes to them. But even disaster movies are political. We always, in a disaster movie, a science fictional disaster movie, the president and all of the cabinet are usually involved in planetary destruction scenarios and what are they going to do about it. And so the politics there rears its ugly head. There's also the concept of dystopia and utopia as well. Utopia is a crazily political thing. We never really see working utopias in science fiction movies. We always see the flawed utopias. The ones we see tend to be Logan's Run, where everything looks great on the surface but isn't. And the Divergent series as well. And even the Hunger Games at the start, if you're living in the cities in the Hunger Games, you're living a very utopian life. So movies tend to veer towards the flawed utopias, whereas science fiction novels have had a few really interesting utopian societies. I mean, of course, there's Thomas More's original utopia from 1516. But you've also got things like Pacific Edge, Kim Stanley Robinson's novel, which is set in a utopia, and it's in the near future utopia too. It's not too far distant. And like all the three novels in that series, it's set in Orange County in California. And it shows that even in a utopia, there can be disagreement, there can be good storytelling and interesting stories to tell on a much smaller scale. Ernest Callenbach's Ecotopia was about a part of America breaking away and forming an ecological society based on husbanding the Earth. And even Star Trek, I mean, Star Trek is set in a utopia, of course, not the reboot, the recent retcon, but the original series and Next Generation particularly were set in post-scarcity utopian societies. So, which again, even though it's underlying the action and the zooming around interstellar space, there's still some political ideas in it, and there are a number of episodes which directly talk to politics and culture. So science fiction is replete with politics, even though a lot of science fiction fans I know aren't particularly political people. The stuff they love is political. And then you've got other things too, like V for Vendetta, another good dystopia where a revolutionary comes along and scaramouches the entire society. And even when you've got a smaller disaster movie, it's like, say, Day of the Triffids. If you read the novel and some of the adaptations, there have been a movie in 1962, which wasn't that good, and two television adaptations of Day of the Triffids. There are political things that come along. How do you organise a society of people after most of the people on the planet get destroyed? How do you rearrange things so that people can function together and not make things worse? These are kind of intrinsic to a lot of these kind of science fiction movies, and they're often dealt with, sometimes they're dealt with better than others, sometimes they're dealt with pretty flippantly. But at other times, a lot of the drama comes from that political to and fro between different factions in a group. Even something like Lord of the Flies, which is science fiction because the kids are trapped on the island after a nuclear war. There's the way the tribes are organized and the kind of burgeoning testosterone and savagery of the children does have a political subtext to it. Even some of the science fiction that we really love from the old days, 1950s invasion movies, there's always a political and military response to the alien invasions, whether it's the kind of ostensibly benign, the day the Earth stood still, where the leaders of the world have to get together to listen to Klaatu tell them basically, get your shit together or we'll destroy you. which is not very pacifistic. People look at it and say, well, you know, he's a pacifist and wants people in the world to be peaceful and not use nuclear power and all that kind of shit. But there's a big stick behind that carrot. And the day the Earth stood still is political in the sense that it's kind of a parallel between Klaatu and his robot Gort and the powers behind them and the way America has treated small countries since World War II, telling them what to do and what not to do and not to use nuclear power, particularly for weapons. Otherwise, they'll be destroyed or co-opted. See, there's a lot of politics in science fiction. Now, the reason I'm talking about politics, of course, is we're now 4 days after the election. I've actually recorded part of the podcast earlier. And we still don't have a government. They're still counting the votes. There's recriminations and much gnashing of teeth and beating of breasts and finger-pointing and blaming and all of those things that people do when they're under stress. But we don't have a government. At the moment, we've got no government in Australia. We've just got the old government doing caretaker mode, but most of what they're doing is talking to journalists on television. That's the extent of our government at the moment. Everything's running along behind the scenes. All the people who do the actual work are doing the actual work. But at the moment, our politicians are very, very busy talking to journalists and trying to calm things down and trying to say, yeah, we're going to win. Don't worry about the other guys. We're going to win. They're all assholes. They did this during the election. Look at what they did. There's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. So politics is very much at the front of Australia's mind. And the fact that a number of very, very nasty politicians with racist and ugly agendas have managed to get into the Senate this time around thanks to the Conservative parties. They called a double dissolution election, which meant all Senate seats were up for grabs, which meant that people who were putting themselves up as Senate candidates only required half as many votes as usual to get into Parliament, which means that a whole bunch of these calicacks got in, and it's going to be very interesting until the next election's called. So that's where my head's at the moment as far as politics is concerned. I thought I'd turn it to science fiction. I mean, you've also got the parallels with science fiction in something like the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original Don Siegel version based on the Jack Finney novel, with its kind of very overt parallels to communism, which go way over the top with the pod people and the alien invasion and the subversion from within and all that kind of stuff. The political parallels are very much strongly in play there in the context of quite a gripping thriller. I'm not taking that at all away from the movie, which I love a lot. Then you've even got more recent movies, which I've kind of had a rethink about this film since I first saw it, and that is Idiocracy, where basically a guy from our time goes into a future where everybody is incredibly stupid because only stupid people breed. And because this guy, who's a fairly average intelligence, played by Luke Wilson, is the smartest man on the planet, he ends up being a presidential advisor to President Camacho, played very broadly and fun by Terry Crews. Idiocracy is an interesting one because, yeah, it is overtly political, of course, and talks to the stupidity of the lower classes. But it's simplistic and it's kind of from a viewpoint of privileged people in some ways. The problem isn't that people are stupid. That's the last thing the problem is with even rednecks and people who vote for the Trumps and the Pauline Hansons of this world. That's not the problem. The problem is that access to education and access to information and access to broader culture than is found sometimes in rural areas is the thing that makes people the way that movies like Idiocracy portray, and they make people susceptible to the influence of people who offer them simplistic answers. If you're uneducated and have only lived in a small town, even if you're a fairly intelligent person, and if you don't have access to wider knowledge and differing opinions so that you can challenge the ideas you're brought up with and kind of compare them to other ideas and make your own choices about them. If you're not brought up in an environment that encourages you to evaluate, then very easily you can become that sort of person. It's not a function of native intelligence. It's a function of nurture more than nature. And Idiocracy doesn't really take any of that into account. It assumes that if a whole bunch of people are fairly low intelligence breed, they're going to uniformly breed morons. That's not the case at all. There's a hybrid vigor to be involved. Scientists who listen, particularly people like our great friend and podcast supporter Elaine, will be able to go into reasons why Idiocracy's basic premise is bullshit. But essentially, it assumes that most of the people, most of the time, are dumb. No, not necessarily. They may be susceptible to certain influences, but I don't believe that at all they're dumb. And so I've reevaluated Idiocracy since I first saw it. I still like it. I still like a lot of the comedy. I still like it as a cautionary tale. But I think that it's a little bit mean-spirited in some ways. And I find that very troublesome. And you've also got movies like District 9, which talks directly to the apartheid era in South Africa, Neil Blomkamp's movie, with Sholto Kopili in it, in a role that he's never exceeded. And it's about segregation. It's about the experience of black people in apartheid South Africa done in the context of aliens. And sometimes that's a good way of getting the message across. There's a science fiction can be a really good instrument for putting a point across and giving people access to things they don't necessarily want to think about them by clouding it slightly in a more attractive package. It's the way that a recent Australian TV series, Clever Man, which if you get a chance to see, you should see it. I don't think it's perfect, but I think it does give us a different culture's viewpoint on the world and on Australia in particular. And again, that has a lot of politics to it. A lot of the issues that Clever Man addresses are social, yes, and cultural as well with Indigenous culture. But they're also very, very political. And I think that the way it's handled is very good in that. It takes us from the corridors of power down to the street level and back again very easily. There are a couple of characters that kind of form that bridge between the street and the top end of town in Clever Man. But I think that it's done pretty well. There is going to be a second series of Clever Man, which I look forward to. The last episode of Clever Man in the first series is showing next week, and I'm looking forward to it. I think there's a couple of problems with the storytelling, but that may not be a problem with the storytelling. That may just be my own cultural prejudices about the way stories are told. And I'm expecting this TV series, which is made predominantly by Indigenous Australians, to tell stories in the same way as the stories I'm used to seeing on television. And it doesn't. And I'm kind of trying to evaluate how much of that is people being fairly new at making TV series and how much of it is that cultural baggage that I carry as a viewer when I watch something like Clever Man. I like it a lot. I think it's a good near future science fiction thing which addresses issues of now. And I want to see more of that kind of stuff on television. I really want to see different cultures have their say and have their moment in the sun as far as genre cinema is concerned. It's something that I look forward to and I find quite exciting because you can get a bit stale just hearing one culture's viewpoint in science fiction of all sorts. And to get cultural diversity in gives us a much broader entertainment, and also it gives us that really lovely thing of learning something while we're being entertained. And that is a great pleasurable thing, having your kind of cultural assumptions challenged and learning something new and interesting about a different culture while you're having fun and enjoying an entertainment. I mean, there's no downside to that. A, you're being entertained, and B, you're learning something, both of which are good things. It's just the best of both worlds in a lot of ways. Then you can go back to things like Metropolis, a very political film about the suppression of the majority by a minority who live very, very well. Not that that could ever happen in our world. All of the post-nuclear movies and movies about nuclear war like Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove have basic political themes in them. When is it acceptable to launch an attack on an enemy which may totally obliterate them? In what circumstances is that morally justifiable, and what are the consequences of doing so? That's a political decision which has kind of triggered 1,000 good and bad science fiction movies. The Mad Max movies have political subtext to it as well. There's the politics of the police force in the first one, and then there are the different societies that are created in the kind of post-apocalyptic era in all of the Mad Max movies. Again, the politics of those societies plays into the action. And in a different way, movies like Destination Moon, where private enterprise builds the first spaceship to the moon because government doesn't have the resources or the know-how to do it. That's basic Robert Heinlein, who wrote the original screenplay. That's Heinlein's libertarianism coming to play and assuming that a bunch of businesses can do things better than businesses being coordinated by government. Not necessarily true, given that the Juno space probe, which was a government enterprise, has just reached Jupiter today and is going to show us in more depth the largest planet in our solar system. That wasn't done by private enterprise. That was done by a government working with private enterprise to show us our neighborhood, basically. And even fantasy movies and TV shows are political. Game of Thrones is about little else beside politics. So the question arises, of course, does politics make science fiction more interesting or less interesting? Well, it depends on a few things. First off, it depends on whether you like politics, which is always a big ask for science fiction fans at times. Secondly, I think it's a useful dramatic tool. It's a way of kind of upping the ante in a lot of ways in science fiction. A lot of it's very intrinsic to science fiction as well. You can't really have a dystopian movie without having a political aspect to it. It's kind of built into the structure of it. But and even horror films, I mean, horror films have political aspects to them as well. That's why there was a movie of great renown which is horrible, and I don't recommend anybody really sees it. I'm actually going to rewatch it myself, called The Werewolf of Washington, which had Dean Stockwell in it. I don't remember much about it except that it was pretty bad. Nonetheless, I'm probably going to rewatch that one just because it's come to mind while I'm talking about politics. It's very much Nixon-era politics. It was made in the 1970s. And, of course, then there's movies like They Live, which talks to the Reagan era of American politics. Very much the wonderful John Carpenter movie with Rowdy Roddy Piper and Keith David. By the way, if you get a chance, read 8 o'clock in the morning by Ray Nelson, which is the original story on which They Lived is based. It's a tight little paranoid story, I think from the late 1950s. It plays out a bit differently than the movie does, but it's really a nice little kind of paranoid and unusual science fiction story of its time. I'm fairly sure you can find it online without too much difficulty. Then you got to look at things like Escape from New York and Escape from L.A. Again, John Carpenter movies. Again, political too. First one, you rescue the president, and the second one, the president's an asshole. And let me have a look at some other John Carpenters to see if we've got any other political stuff happening there. There's a little bit of it in Starman. There's not much of it in Big Trouble in Little China. There's a bit of it in Memoirs of the Invisible Man. Village of the Damned, of course. Ghost of Mars is really interesting politically because it's about a time when Mars is colonized and terraformed, and women are in positions that men are in a more traditional Western society, and that makes it kind of an interesting experiment. I don't think it's the most successful movie ever. It doesn't blend the science fiction with the Western aspect very well. But, yeah, full points to Carpenter for kind of flipping the gender roles to a large extent. And It's a shame he hasn't done more films. I really like John Carpenter as a director, and I want to see more of his stuff. I'm going to wind this one up anyway for now. Before I start the Patreon credits, I will give special credits to the two people who aren't on the roll yet for the Patreon credits. The first being Steve Sullivan, who's our monster effects director. And we have our transportation co-captain, who is Richard, formerly of Wichita. So thank you to them, and thank you to all of the other Patreon subscribers. And as usual, here after I do the end blurb, are the credits in the style of movie credits for the Patreon subscribers. So anyway, in the meantime, keep watching the skies. Watch good movies, watch bad movies, enjoy yourself, watch movies with people you love, watch them by yourself. It doesn't really matter as long as you watch movies. I'll be back in a week with, well, less than a week now because I'm recording this one late, with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and then in a week and a half with another Martian Drive-In podcast. Look after yourselves, take care, and hopefully next time I speak to you, Australia will have a government. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Kerry, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.